This is Michael Gannett with the Middle East Research Center Limited, and this is Insight to Israel. Another Sunday bringing you the truth of the Jewish state and its blessing and prosperity, and yet its struggle for sovereignty and security. And I want to say thank you to America's Web Radio for allowing Americans to see firsthand, to hear firsthand about the Jewish state. I want to thank you guys. Appreciate you. It's been a fantastic week. I've had got some military style training from some guys that were in the special forces called Duv Divan. I want to thank Roy Pelid, if he's listening, to the guys at Expert Security for running me through the mill. And I know it's mild compared to what I'll experience here in 3 weeks when they actually start training 16 and 17 year old Israeli young people, male and female both, who know exactly what they want to do in the military. And free of charge, they take these young people and they prepare them physically, mentally, emotionally for what they're going to go through and experience in basic training in the military and beyond. So these guys are fantastic, and I'm thankful for them. We're actually going to do another interview with Roy coming up very shortly. This week, though, I have a fantastic schedule coming up, and I will be headed, a military vehicle will be picking me up, and I will be headed to a base on the border with the Gaza. So that should be very interesting. And at the same time that you're hearing this broadcast, I'm recording on a Friday, but there has been a threat against all American embassies in Muslim countries, all over North Africa and the Middle East, and in parts of Europe. So they'll be shutting down the embassies on Sunday, which is something they don't normally do. And the reason why it's on Sunday is because in the Middle East, and in other parts of the world, Sunday is the first day of the work week. In the opposite of the United States, where our first day of the work week is on Monday. So all the embassies will be shut down because of a threat. Now, if this were just idle chatter that they're hearing, which they hear on a regular basis, the intelligence, then that would be one thing. But this has become a serious threat. And it's funny because temporarily I spent 7 months in Jerusalem, and right now I'm in an area called Ramat Gan, which is in Tel Aviv. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. If anything does at all, we hope and pray it won't. But these are very, very serious days in which we live and should not be taken lightly. And I want to say, and we're going to get to the interview here, but I just want to say many times, and I've gotten some reprimand this week from some folks in the States. Some of them are left-wing Jews, which many times in their ideology end up being a threat to their own people here in Israel. But we should never take Islam in general lightly, because you have three kinds of Muslims, and let me explain this. You have the kind that want to convert and want to get out of Islam, but for many reasons they can't, because they will die, they will be killed. The Quran calls for that. Now, look, we'll go through this another time, and I'll quote you scripture in context from the Quran. Then you have the Muslims that don't pull the trigger or detonate the bomb, that their excuse for not standing up against the violence, and those that do, is, I just want to live my life. You know, I'm peaceful. I have no, I don't want to bring harm to other people. And while that may be true, there is that their silence, number one, is complicit and condoning of those that are violent. Their silence runs along the line of scriptures in the Quran that calls for violence, that calls for death to the Jews, that calls for the death of the infidel openly. And they are as bad as those who don't do the killing. When you have a religion of a billion people, a small percentage, even 10%, turns into literally millions and millions, tens of millions of Muslims that wreak havoc violently all over the world on a daily basis. So let's not be fooled. There is no Allah. There are no virgins waiting. And Muhammad was a madman, a child molesting madman that went all throughout the Middle East, slaughtering, forcing conversions on people. So I want to get that in on the record of how I see Islam. Islam is the enemy. There is no peaceful Islam. So let's set that straight. Even for people who say, well, there are good Muslims, it's unacceptable. Because I don't see these folks protesting. It is unacceptable. It's an unacceptable ideology that is political, that's religious, and that is also an economy in itself. Anyway, enough of that. It's my show, so I get to say what I want and do what I want. So that's the good thing. Anyway, I have had the privilege this week. I actually went to Bibi Netanyahu's prime minister home, his government home in Jerusalem, because the Israelis, with great pressure from the EU, from the United States, from John Kerry, who is a very wicked man, who has no good intent for the Jewish people, he or Barack Hussein Obama, have pressured the Israeli government to release hundreds of prisoners who have maimed and murdered Jews in cold blood. And I've read some of the accounts of what some of these men have done to the Jewish people. Killed children, killed pregnant mothers, with no thought. And it's all for Islam. It is all for what the Quran calls for. So at this protest of people who did not want release of Muslim prisoners that are on the militant side of Islam, I met some fantastic people. In fact, I'm working on the video now. But I got to meet quite a few people that are Americans that live here in Israel, and they are true Zionists, and I hold them in high regard. And what's funny is, at this protest, there were probably more women than there were men. There's probably a lot of reasons for that, but it's unfortunate that many times we see women taking a stronger stand than we do the men. So men, it's time to tighten up. It's time to, you know, pull up your bootstraps, dig in your heels, and fight. And so, anyway, I got to talk to some young ladies who live here, two of which, they came by themselves. And one specifically, and this is why I wanted to do this interview with Jenna, is because she is one of the Americans that I find are very exceptional here in the Jewish state. I want to say that I am thankful to American Jews who have the fortitude, the courage, the conviction, the principle, the guts to leave and abandon all of the comfort of the United States, which is now becoming ever increasingly uncomfortable, to come to the Jewish state and live and stand and fight with their Jewish brothers and sisters. I applaud them, I embrace them, and I stand shoulder to shoulder with them. And so anyway, we have a young lady by the name of Jenna
Lippman.
I apologize, Jenna. Sometimes I draw a blank. And just for the record, you're going to have to speak up just a little loud. You have a soft voice, so. But Jenna is from, where are you from?
Pulaski, Tennessee.
Pulaski, Tennessee. Wow. Did not know there were Jews in Pulaski.
We're the only ones.
The only ones?
The only ones.
Now, how many would you say are in your area in Pulaski?
Jews or people?
Jews.
Just my family, literally. My mom, my dad, me, my sister, and my grandparents.
Wow. Wow. So, wow. Wow. That's, those are some pretty low numbers there, you know?
Yeah.
So, wow. So, Jenna, first of all, this is a great area. It's Gush Etzion.
Gush Etzion.
There's some great people here for Shabbat that I'm going to be having dinner with and hanging out with later this evening, and that I've gotten to meet since I've been here. It's been fantastic, but I narrowed it down There's some people that I'm going to have on the radio show, but it's Shabbat, so they're a little more, they want to rest, and I respect that. They're religious. I respect the fact that they respect Shabbat. But I wanted to interview Jenna specifically because I think that she has a great story to tell. Jenna, first of all, I want to ask you, what was it like growing up in Pulaski, Tennessee? Now, Pulaski's where? Tell us what that's near. What big town is that near?
It's an hour and 15 minutes away from Nashville.
Okay.
But I lived on the Tennessee-Alabama state line, so I was really much more closer to Huntsville, Alabama than Nashville.
Right. Now, you have a great story. First of all, we're going to start off because we want to set a time frame here. How old are you?
I am 23.
23. And you're here in the Jewish state alone?
Alone.
Now, you have lots of friends and family, of course.
I have aunts and cousins and uncles, you know. But my parents and my sister and my grandparents, my immediate family is in America.
Okay. So, I want to start off by asking you, being the only Jews in Pulaski, Tennessee, what was that like growing up?
Well, my family were business owners, so we always, I knew everybody, and they always knew. They knew we were Jews. I never really had problems. My parents always made sure to come to the school and talk to my class about, you know, the religion and about the holidays. My grandparents are Holocaust survivors, and my grandparents came to the school and spoke and told their stories. We made sure that they were educated, that they knew, but, you know, sometimes we would, you know, maybe get a letter in the mail. Nobody would ever put their names on it,
right.
Of course, but you could tell they were from churches or, you know, I mean, honestly, people would try to, like, convert us and tell us that, like, what we were doing was wrong and things like that, but...
That's one thing I can't understand. Look, I'm a Christian, and I'll be perfectly upfront. I think everybody needs to embrace Christianity. There's reasons for that. We don't need to go into it. It's not important. At the same time, for you as a Jew to get a letter in the mail?
Yeah. I mean,
that's pretty strange.
You know, I also had kids that would come up to me in school and say, you know, they're just uneducated people. Like, you know, you killed Jesus. Like, I killed
Jesus. That's insane.
Or, you know, Jew jokes, and they think they're funny, but they never really, they don't know the meaning behind them. And when I sit down and then I explain to them, like, listen, it's really not funny. Like, you know, jokes about the Holocaust or anything like that. You know, when I sit down and I really explain it to them and let them know, they think about it and they take it back. They understand. And I feel like the part is that most of America, or Americans, or people in general, not just Americans, are uneducated about Judaism.
Right.
And they don't know.
Well, let me say this. And again, I don't want to go into a bunch of detail, but for those that are ignorant that say they are Christian... the Jews did not kill the Christian, or did not kill Jesus. The Jews didn't. The Romans didn't. The fact of the matter remains that New Testament Scripture says that from the foundation of the world, he was meant to die. From the time that God created the heaven and the earth, he, in his foreshadow, in his foreknowledge, he's the Alpha and Omega. He knew that he would have to send his only Son to die for the sins of mankind, because we would never be able to attain that perfection. We would never, because he's a holy God, but yet still loving. So I wanted to clarify that for people who are listening in the United States. The Jews and the Romans did not kill Christ. He was meant to die. He knew that in coming. So it amazes me, the ignorance of people. Ignorance. It's just, and you know what? I don't give room for ignorance anymore, because there's a wealth of information. False or real, true or false, there is still a wealth of information. And I believe sincerely that if a man wants truth or a woman wants truth, if they hunger for it enough, they'll find it. And they'll know what it is, because truth is a very powerful thing. 1 + 1 will always be 2. We try to make it like it sound like it's so difficult, but truth is not a difficult thing, you know? Anyway, So you grew up in this town, and were your parents practicing? Like, as far as look, there's different levels. We see the religious who wear the kippah and they keep Shabbat and things like that. And there's rules in Torah on the life of a Jew.
Right.
But then you have the Haredi,
right,
or the guys that wear the black and the white, and they're a little more stricter. They spend all their life studying
Torah all day, all night.
The first five books of the Bible.
Right.
So what was it like growing up in your home?
Growing up in my home, my parents always made it really, really, really important that we knew we were Jewish. But they also made sure that we were educated also about other religions. Many Christmases I spent with my friends, and many Hanukkahs my friends spent with me.
Yeah, so you were surrounded by a lot of Christians.
All my friends were Christian.
Yeah.
I mean, I know a lot about Christianity, I feel like. And I'm glad that I'm educated on that part.
Right.
But my parents always made sure that it was in our house, and that, you know, we felt that we were Jewish. You know, also my grandparents, because, you know, they were Holocaust survivors, when they came to America, it was important for them to build a big family and us be close and know our religion and know who we are.
Right.
You know, I lived in a small town where there was no synagogue, but my parents made sure that every Sunday, you know, I went to Sunday school an hour and a half away.
Now explain that, because they explained that to me, Sunday school.
So I grew up here.
When I hear Sunday school, I automatically
think of church.
Yeah.
Okay, so I can call it religious school, but it's on Sundays. It was actually called religious school, but we called it Sunday school
because
it was on Sundays.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was in my synagogue.
You said it was Reformed Jew?
It was very Reformed, very Reformed. Microphone on Shabbat, you know, man and wife, rabbi, etc., etc.
Right.
Anyways, I went every Sunday till 10th grade, till I went through my confirmation. And I knew, you know, I studied Hebrew, I had a bat mitzvah, I knew that I was a Jew, but I only got to see my Jewish friends every Sunday.
Right.
I grew up in public school my whole life with...
Government, we call it government-run school now.
It is government-run school, actually. But I grew up in public government-run school, and... It was important to me that my friends knew I was Jewish and what it was. You know, anytime they would ever ask if they could come with me to synagogue to say, I would always say yes. I would always want them to come and you know, experience it. And they would say, you know, they would say, Genevieve, how do you know what they're saying?
Because it was in Hebrew.
It was in Hebrew, but it was half in Hebrew, half in English.
Yeah.
Because
I've got one
America
of those song books that were one side's in Hebrew
exactly.
And singing the songs
exactly.
On Shabbat.
Exactly. My parents always made sure that it was in our home. My mother didn't light candles or anything like that every Shabbat, but she did at least once a month. I always remember watching my mom light candles. And if I didn't see my mom doing it, I saw my grandmother doing it. And, you know, my dad never wore a yarmulke, a kippah all day.
Now, is yarmulke Yiddish? Let me ask that.
I think so, actually. I'm not really sure, but I think so. Sounds Yiddish. Anyways, my father never wore one all day, every day, but whenever he would walk into the synagogue or walk into, like, the actual, where it is that we pray, like the, what's it called? The room. Whatever, the synagogue. When he walked in, he would put a kippah on out of respect, you know, because it's what you do. Not everybody, but my father, I always remember him putting it on. Holidays, you know, Passover, we had a Seder. Hanukkah, you know, we lit candles every night. Yom Kippur, we always fasted. It wasn't that I didn't know I was Jewish. We just didn't, you know, keep Shabbat every Shabbat. I didn't grow up eating kosher. I grew up in a small town where it wasn't available for me.
Right.
It wasn't an option unless I wanted to be a vegetarian, which I like meat, so...
So, you know, it's funny, you mentioned something. You said that you went to Vacation Bible School when you were a kid. That's, anyone who knows, like, I grew up with this my whole life. Like, anyone who's an American kid whose parents raised you right, in some form or fashion, in a Christian home, you know what Vacation Bible School is. It's the time in the summertime when all the kids get together at church and they play games and hear Bible stories and things like that. And a lot of that comes, a lot of that's in the stories I remember being told were in the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I remember going to Vacation Bible School with friends a lot because, like you said, it was an outing and all my friends were there. I grew up in a small town and I didn't have Jewish friends. So, you know, they all invited me to come to Vacation Bible School and it's a fun outing. And I also learned, like, you know, that's why I say I really feel like I'm educated in Christianity because I grew up with Christians, and I know, and I went to Vacation Bible School, but not, you know, it's not like I went to church every Sunday or anything
right.
like that, but
right.
I went to Vacation Bible School because it was more like
a thing to do.
It was fun, and they invited me, so I said yes, you know, just like if I ever wanted to invite my friends to something at my synagogue, they would also come.
Yeah. So let me ask you, but overall, by Christians overall, you were treated...
Fine. Yeah. I don't know if any of you guys know, but Pulaski, Tennessee is home of the Ku Klux Klan. It's not
Did it originate there?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know.
It's home. It originated in Pulaski, Tennessee. You guys can look it up. I don't really know all the history on it. They march around our courthouse once a year. Most of them are not, the ones that march around the courthouse aren't from our town because they don't want you to see their face. They don't want you to know.
Right.
There's a lot of license plates from Kentucky and Alabama.
Wow.
That's
pathetic.
And for some reason, it always lands on my birthday every year. Every year. And, it's not that, you know, I always felt like... I couldn't always tell everybody I was Jewish. I always felt like there was something that still held me back from being so totally open about it.
Right. Well, just for the record, and I've heard this in Israel quite a few times, enough times to make me sit up and take notice that people have said, oh, you have the Ku Klux Klan there. And I'm like, we do, but they're not. They're insignificant.
The only reason I mentioned the Ku Klux Klan is just to give people
an idea
of really how small of a town in the South that I came from.
Yeah. And so I've kind of had to quell this a few times because the biggest threat right now, anyone that keeps up with the media, anyone that sees what's going on in the news, the biggest threat to the United States right now is Islam. Right now there's 32 Muslim training camps in the United States, the CIA, FBI, and local police can do nothing and won't do anything because of fear of legal reprisals. In the military training manuals, CIA and FBI training manuals, they are teaching political correctness by separating anything to deal with terrorism and Islam together. Islam is not associated with terrorism in their training manuals. The fact of the matter is, anyone in the United States who keeps up with what's going on, it is infiltrated and making an inroad hugely, like it's already done in Europe. Side note, but so you grew up with a relatively normal fashion, of course, except for the fact that your parents are trying to little by little.
I grew up as a Reform Jew.
Yeah,
a very Reform Jew, but Reform, but Inform.
Had your parents? Now, you're here in Israel now. We'll get to why you're here. But before you came to Israel, was there any encouragement in your home to go to Israel, to visit Israel?
No. I have an uncle who lives here. Well, he passed away 5 years ago. But I always remember him coming to visit, and my uncle was religious. Big, long beard. He always had a kippah.
Yeah.
You know, he was religious.
Yeah.
And I don't even really remember seeing him in jeans so much. He was always in dress pants and a button-up.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly, I was young. But I always remember being really interested in what is it, and I always used to speak to him about it. And he always knew that I really wanted to come, and he would always make an effort to tell me, Jenny, you have to come, but from my parents, never.
Wow. That's interesting, and I don't, by no means would I ever cast aspersion or a bad light or anything negative on your parents.
No.
But it makes it very interesting that I've talked to a number of Jews from the United States who had no encouragement. In fact, and yet they feel that yearning. There's that interest.
Look, I can tell you right now, my parents are totally happy in America. I never, I wish, but I never see them coming here. And that's hard for me because I know this is where we should all be.
Right.
But out of all truth, as much as I would love it to have my whole family here, it's just not realistic. It's not...
Well, the simple fact that you're here, And the simple fact, as I hear from American Jews and from Jews here who've never even been to the United States, they look at me consistently and say, American Jews will come because things are going to get tough.
You're right.
And the blame is always, look, I'm going to say this because we're going to take a break here in a minute. But I said this on Facebook the other day. There's this Zionist conspiracy theory, and I think this really needs to be said. There is no Zionist conspiracy theory to take over the world, but I will tell you this. The Jews have created advancements in technology, in agriculture, and in medicine. Okay? Now, in the United States, Jews they run a lot of Hollywood. They run a lot of banks, and they run a lot of the media. So when things go bad, you know who's going to get the blame? The Jews who never cared about the United States. The Jews who have never opened their mouth to support the Jewish state. The Jews who probably sent a few dollars or a few thousand, or even if they send a million. We got guys like Bloomberg, okay, in New York. But at the end of the day, and he only is involved with Israel to boost his ego. He's got his name on things to boost his own ego.
You're right.
And at the end of the day, those Jews that don't care, when the pressure is on, because they are in these status positions, who's going to get the blame?
Jews.
The Jews. And those ones who never cared, their refuge is only going to be in one place.
Yep.
In Israel. Wow, that's powerful. Because they didn't care before, they never gave thought. Yeah, they might even come to visit here. But at the end of the day, there was not that love, that concern, that cherishing of the Jewish state after 2,000 years.
Yeah.
And they are going to pay a very, very heavy price for ignoring Hashem. And if Bloomberg's listening, which he probably is not, his ego that he feeds, his liberal ego that he feeds, it will come back to haunt him 1,000 times over. Anyway, listen, Jenna, we're going to take a break and come back and talk about how you ended up here in the Jewish state.
Great.
We'll be right back. Thank you for the time, Jenna. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Michael Gannot with the Middle East Research Center Limited, bringing you insight to Israel, the truth about the greatness of the Jewish state and its struggle for sovereignty and security, every Sunday at 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And we're back. This is Michael Gannot with Middle East Research Center Limited and Insight to Israel. Another Sunday, another beginning of a work week here in the Jewish state, and it's fantastic. I'm here with Jenna Lippman from Pulaski, Tennessee, who is now an Israeli citizen. And Jenna has given us some great insight into her upbringing. And I want to pick up, Jenna, with your uncle,
mm-hmm.
who recently passed or has been passed
for 5 years ago.
5 years ago. And obviously, he planted a seed. Your parents laid the foundation of good soil in your life, it seems like.
Yeah.
But that soil needed a seed. And it seems as though, if I understand correctly from your verbiage, that your uncle, when visiting, planted that seed in that good soil.
Yeah. I came to visit Israel for my first time in the summer of 2008. I was 17, turned 18 here. I came for 10 days on a trip that Nashville, the first time Nashville had ever done it. It was called Get Connected. It was a trip that they fully paid for, almost. We maybe paid $350 each per kid, something like that. To be able to come to Israel for 10 days.
What a program. That's awesome.
It's amazing. To be able to come to Israel for 10 days and tour from top to bottom the country and learn about Israel and what's right and what's wrong and et cetera, et cetera.
The history. And
exactly. So
did you go to the Knesset?
We didn't go in the Knesset, but we went by. We saw it. They showed it to us. This is the building.
Yeah.
I mean, it's 10 days, and they pack so much into those 10 days.
Right.
I mean, really, if you sit here and ask me about that trip, I can't even tell you. I just know I can go to a place and go, oh, I was there on my 10-day Get Connected trip to Israel. But really, it was so much, and they packed so much. I regret not taking a journal and writing everywhere we went and everything we did because there was so much So much.
So that means you're keeping a journal now.
Actually, I write every now and then when I feel like it,
yeah.
When I need to talk to somebody.
So let me ask you, so had your parents been to Israel before?
Yes, my parents were here 15 or 16 years ago for my cousin's bar mitzvah. And my father came here with me when I moved here in March 31st, 2010, I moved to Israel.
So your parents had only been here one other time.
Right.
Before you actually came.
Right.
And it was 15, 16 years prior.
Right.
So what did they think when you said, oh, I want to go on this trip? Like, did you do research into the organization?
The Get Connected trip?
Yeah.
It was the first time that Nashville had ever done that trip.
It was the first time that Nashville...
Right. The Nashville Jewish community.
Ah, okay.
Like the Federation.
Okay. Yeah.
Had collected money. Actually, the Madoff had a lot to do with it also. He donated a lot of money.
Who?
Madoff, before he got in trouble for everything.
Bernie Madoff?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Now that makes it interesting. Wow, so how many Jews are in Nashville?
Nashville has it's not a small Jewish community. There's quite a few Jews. There's my synagogue, two other conservative synagogues, a Orthodox synagogue, and now there's Chabad. So there's actually five different synagogues in Nashville.
Wow, that's an interesting...
Maybe six, even.
To think that Bernie Madoff got that started, wow.
He didn't get it started, but he donated a lot of money.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying that. Wow, that's very interesting. So you found out about this trip?
Through the Jewish community. I was very active in high school with a youth organization called BBYO, B'nai B'rith Youth Organization.
Okay.
And I made sure to put a lot of effort into that because that was my connection to Judaism and to
right.
Jewish friends and
right.
to that type of friendship with other Jews.
Wow.
And, I found out about the trip that way, and I said, whoa, there's no way I can say no. And plus, it was a way to get me here to visit all my family that I never get to see.
Wow. So what did your parents think when
they were totally for it.
You sat down. So I'm trying to picture this. You sat down.
I didn't pay the $350 to come here. They did.
So
for the trip.
Right. So I'm trying to picture this in my head. I'm a picture guy.
They were so happy.
So would you sit down around the dining room table and say, I need to talk to you about.
No. I think maybe they were even the ones that told me about the trip.
Wow.
It
wow.
wasn't me. Anyways, went on the 10-day trip. It was great. When everybody decided they were flying back to Nashville, I decided I'm going to stay for another month and visit
wow.
with my family here.
And you were 18 at the time.
I turned 18 while here. I was 17 at the time, 18. I turned 18 here during that extra month. I was also able to be here for my cousin's bar mitzvah, which was an amazing experience.
Yeah.
And I flew back to America a few days after the bar mitzvah. And the day after I flew back to America, my uncle passed away.
Wow.
Of a massive heart attack at a spa.
The same uncle that planted the seed.
The same uncle that planted the seed. And the whole time I was
wow.
here, he kept saying, Jenny, you don't have to go back to America to finish your senior year in high school. You should just stay. And I said, listen, it's my senior year. Just let me finish.
Right.
Think about coming back after that. Think about coming back. I never
yeah.
said I'll come back.
You know, it's interesting you say that because I was on the bus one day in Jerusalem. And there was a girl from an American girl that had a big luggage sitting next to her on the bus. I knew what was going on. I knew what her situation was. I didn't even have to know her because I've seen it 1,000 times. And I said, are you going on a trip? And she said, I am. Like in that 18-year-old innocent, like giddy kind of way. And I said, well, where are you going? She said, I'm going home. And I said, well, where's home? And she said, New Jersey. Again, I can just picture this girl in just such a giddy, like, laughable, friendly kind of way. And I asked her very intently. I said, are you Jewish? And she said, I am. And I looked her, I'll never forget, right in the eyes, very intently. And I said, you are home. You are home. And she was so overwhelmed by that, she didn't know what to do with it. And I said, when you get home, you tell the American Jews. Now, nobody knows who I am, but I said, you tell them, Michael Gouneau said, that they have a responsibility to the people in this country to come here and live and bring all of their greatness back to the Jewish state and make the Jewish state even better than what it is now. And so her one question was, well, where would we all live? And I said to her, it's not a matter of where you would live after 2,000 years and Hashem giving you your homeland back. It's a matter of, where do I want to live? It's a matter of, where do I choose to live now that I'm back in the Jewish state? Where does God want me to live? That's the question you must not only ask yourself, but prayerfully ask Hashem, God, where do you want me to be now that I hear the call, because I'm open, now that I hear the call to come back home after 2,000 years? It's very powerful. So anyway, so you come back to the States with that mindset, because many times...
I come back to this...
Let me say this. Many times, people come...
And people go.
They have a good time, and they say, oh, I'd like to come back. And they go about their lives once they get back to the States.
Right. I went back to the States, found out that my uncle passed away, and the whole time I'm thinking about everything he said to me. Jenna, you should stay. It's like he knew.
Right.
It's like he knew he was going to die, and it's like he knew that he had to express it to me while I was here. And he did. He did a good job at it. I went back, started college, and realized that just wasn't for me at the time at all. I wasn't happy. It's not what I wanted to be doing. And I thought, I need to go to Israel. It's what I want to do. It's where I want to be. It's where I said I wanted to go. It's where I said I wanted to go after high school. And I looked into different programs, what I should do, what I shouldn't do, how to get myself here, and what I would do when I got here.
It's not an easy country.
It's not an easy country.
It's a blessed country.
It's very blessed, but it's not easy. You have to want it, and you have to want to be here. If not, you won't last.
I had people making bets on how long I would last. And I have to say, look, I've eaten more egg sandwiches in my life since I've been here.
And tuna.
Egg sandwiches. Tuna, not so much, but okay. We're coming from your perspective. I've eaten more egg sandwiches because I live on a very strict budget here. And I'm not saying that out of woe. I'm not saying that because it's, you know, because I'm being negative. But I want to be here because I know there's a truth that needs to be said. That's why I'm talking to you now.
Right.
And why people are listening. So So how old were you when you decided, okay, I'm going back to Israel?
19.
You were 19.
I was 19 years old. I decided I wanted to go back to Israel.
So what did your parents say?
They were all for it.
And they bought the plane ticket?
They bought my plane ticket. Did they buy my plane ticket, they bought my plane ticket knowing that I was moving to Israel to enlist in the IDF.
In the Israeli Defense Force.
Exactly.
So you'd made up your mind even before you stepped foot back in the country that you were going to go? Into the IDF?
Yeah.
Did you?
I registered for a program called Mahal, which is a volunteer service in the IDF for American, not only American citizens, for Jews from outside of Israel. You had to be Jewish. And I filled out the application online, you know, a small questionnaire, you know, why do you want to do it? Why do you think, you know, it's your right to serve for the IDF? And
what'd you say to them? Didn't you have to write some kind of paragraph or something?
It's a small paragraph. They tell you, like, between, like, 50 to 100 words. They don't want a lot. And you know, the first thing that I think I put was, this is my home. Why wouldn't I want to come?
Wow.
Why wouldn't I want to fight?
Wow.
I moved here March 31st, 2010. My plane landed. That was my sister's birthday. And I joined the IDF May 4th, which was a month and 4 days.
Wow.
I went into the Army knowing absolutely nothing.
No Hebrew.
You want to know the true definition of total shock? That was me. I went into the IDF in total shock. I thought to myself the first day, oh my gosh, these people are yelling at me in Hebrew. I have no idea what they're saying. What have I gotten myself into?
Now, let me say this. You were a lone soldier.
I was a lone soldier.
And anyone that has followed, whether it's my Facebook page or get my email updates, a lone soldier is a soldier that comes from, they come from all over the world, not just the United States, but from all over the world. They come here with no real family or friends, no real undergirding or a foundation.
To be a lone soldier, you have to be here without a mother and a father.
Without a mother and a father. So you, wow, that's, and how old were you?
19.
Say it again. How old were you?
19.
19 years old in a foreign country, do not know the language, and you're joining the military.
Exactly.
Now, that's crazy. That's crazy.
Yeah, my friends told me I was crazy at the time, too. Nobody really got it. Why are you serving for Israel? Why don't you go into the American
army? I hear, yeah.
Why Israel? Yeah, da, da, da. And I explained, why Israel? I'm a Jew. It's my home. I want to fight for my home.
Wow, because, you know, look, there's two kinds of people in the world, Jenna. The few and the many. The few and the many. And I'll tell you, there's nothing like being a part of the few.
It's a good feeling.
And it, because it shows character, it shows integrity, it shows principle. Yeah, there's part of the few and that do the wrong thing.
Right.
But to do the right thing.
Right. May 4th, I went into the Army, and they took me to the base where you go and you get, you know, your ID card, your dog tags, your uniform, you know, everything you need for the Army. They put you on a bus and they send you to your base.
Wow.
They put me on a bus. I'll never forget it. They put me on a bus. I called my dad and I said, well, Dad, I did it. I'm in green.
Wow.
And he goes, okay, I'm really proud of you. Take a deep breath. You're going to be okay. It'll be fine. And the whole time, this lady, my commander at the time, I didn't know she was my commander at the time, but she comes up to me and she starts yelling at me on the bus. Me, I don't know any Hebrew. And I'm like, Dad, they're already yelling at me. And the girl sitting beside me, thank goodness, knew English, and she looks at me and she says, she's telling you to get off the phone. I said, oh, Dad, I got to go. Bye.
Look, you know what? I'll tell you. This military, now, there are some things in both U.S. military and the Israeli military that it's very sad political correctness has come into play.
Exactly.
Because I think it hampers us from being a military is made to fight, to kill, destroy the enemy, and wickedness and evil when it's principled.
Exactly.
And you need that toughness.
Right. So they put me on the bus and I got to my base. I was on a base for 3.5 months called Mikve Elon. Where's
that located?
It's up north. It's close to the Kinneret, which is the Sea of Galilee.
Sea of Galilee.
And I was there for 3.5 months with a course for Olim Chodeshim, which are new immigrants. And I had an Olpan there, which is a class to learn Hebrew. And they also took us around the country. They taught us about Israel.
Wow.
And I was really lucky that I had that, because that's where I learned my Hebrew, and that's where I really learned how to adjust to the culture. You know, I'll tell anybody, the best way to do it is to come here and join the Army, because you're mixed in with everybody, with all sorts of people. You know, there's no cliques. It's everybody.
Everybody's in the same boat.
Everybody's in the same boat. You're in the same clothes. You're in the same uniform.
It's beautiful.
And you know, you learn the culture. You learn about the country. And you learn how to adapt and how to live and how, not only that, how to survive.
And when you adapt, right, when you adapt, you overcome.
Exactly.
Now, did you have one specific person that you, a girl that was, that you had found yourself attached to, like, this is going to be my best friend through all this?
Yeah, and she still is my best friend. Her name was Sharon. Her name is Sharon. She lives in Kfar Saba, which is a town, a little, it's outside of Tel Aviv, but in between Jerusalem and Tel Aviv.
And she's Israeli born.
She was Israeli born. Her parents were Israeli, but they moved back to America when she was young. And her family made Aliyah again, came back right before she went into the Army. They came back.
Wow. So what did you do exactly in the military?
I, after after my 3.5 months, I went to a base for Gadna. Gadna, since there's a draft in Israel and everybody has to serve, Gadna is a base where we take in high schoolers and people from abroad who want to come and see what a week is like in the Army.
Nice.
We put them in full uniform.
Wow.
They get to shoot a gun. They do hikes. And you treat them like they're a soldier in the Army. They eat the food. They wake up. They sleep in bunk beds. They have to make their beds.
I've done all that, except shoot the gun.
They have to make their beds perfect. You know, it's we treat them like they're in the Army. That way, if the people from abroad want to come back and serve in the Army, they're not in total shock like I was. I had no idea.
Right.
Or for the kids who live here and are automatically going to be drafted, they have a taste for what's coming.
Wow. Nice. I mean, that's a fantastic program that they were able to discern that you would be right for.
It was great because also for the people that came abroad, I was able to translate, I was able to talk, I was able to communicate with everybody who needed that extra bit of help without the Hebrew.
Wow. That's fantastic. It's amazing what the greatness of this country that they're willing to go through to help.
Yeah.
To help people.
Because we want everybody to be informed.
Right.
It's important.
Right. Wow. Amazing. So now you're out of the military.
Now I'm out of the military. Just a reminder for everybody.
Let me back up here. What was one of your? Can you think of one of your highlights while you were in the military for almost two years?
Honestly, there were a lot of highlights. There were a lot of things that I did that I got to experience. You know. Of course, I felt so cool because I'm carrying around this, you know, M16. For those of you that don't know, I'm about 4'11" and not so tall. And it was fun, you know, just the whole experience. It really made me feel like I was a part of the country and that I was giving instead of, you know, the first time I came, I felt like I was receiving.
Right.
And I felt like I was able to come back and I was able to give. And just for everybody to remember, the whole time that I was serving in the Army, I was still only an American citizen. I was not Israeli. I was here on a visa.
Wow. Very interesting. So when did you become a full-fledged Israeli citizen?
I became a full-fledged Israeli citizen December 2012.
Wow,
not
nice.
Not too long ago.
Wow, nice. Now, what did that feel like for you?
Amazing. It just felt like finally, why didn't I do it when I first came? You know, I came and I said, look, I'm going to do the Army and I'll see how I feel after that. If I need to go back to America and go back to school, if I want to go back to America and work, you know, what I want to do.
Right.
And I knew after my first 2 months in the Army that I wasn't going back to America.
Wow, that's, look, I mean, you know what? It's amazing, and I'm not going to say all. I don't want to make a blanket statement, because I like to make blanket statements when they're appropriate, and a lot of times they are. but, you know, even at your age, when I was 17, I had no clue what I wanted to do. None. I had zero direction for my life. And it's not that my parents didn't raise me right, or that, you know, I came from a fantastic home. But I at 18, 19 years old, I still didn't know. I'm here now only because about 10 years ago, I was involved, got involved in politics, a little over 10 years. And I have a degree in education. And but little by little, those seeds were planted in me, and I knew eventually I wanted to be here in this country to fight, to tell the truth about the greatness of the Jewish state, to have that ability.
Right.
So, what are you doing now? You're out of the military, so you live here in a very controversial part of Israel.
I live in a very controversial part of Israel, Gush Etzion, also known as the West Bank. I live in a settlement.
Actually, new neighborhood. I like to call them new neighborhood.
I was getting ready to say I don't like to call them settlements. I live in a very nice gated community. Beautiful place.
With armed guards.
With armed guards, of course. But a beautiful gated community, beautiful homes, beautiful people, beautiful children.
Children, I've noticed this.
Private school, a pool, tennis courts, parks on every corner.
And I've noticed here, it's amazing that the children run freely.
Without shoes. They run freely. You don't... I'm telling you...
Some of the people I've met in this area are just fantastic.
Listen, it's a whole... It's much different than growing up in Jerusalem. People from Jerusalem move here because you have a yard, you have a house, you're not living in apartment buildings on top of each other. You have a place for your kids to play, and you don't have to worry. It's a gated community. We don't feel threatened. When I look out my window...
You have Arab neighborhoods, Muslim neighborhoods.
I can look out the window here now, and what do we see? On the hilltops, everywhere surrounding us, are Muslims. But you know what? I don't feel threatened. Never.
No, there are...
I leave my house, I don't lock my door.
Yeah. Wow.
When I go to sleep at night, I never think of locking my door. It's just something that... You know, when my parents were here visiting 3 months... Two months ago. They would leave my house and they would lock the door. And I was like, Mom, you don't have to. Like, you know?
Wow.
Dad, you don't have to. It's okay. And they still said, no, lock the door. And I said, that's the difference also, you know, in feeling... I feel much safer here. Even though I live surrounded by Muslims.
There have been incidents.
Stonings, etc., with cars, but there hasn't been anyone killed from our yeshuv, from our neighborhood, and
unfortunately, in other neighborhoods, it's not the case.
And unfortunately, yeah, but Tekoa, which is the name of where I live, my yeshuv, our head rabbi, who also passed away not too long ago, was very active with trying to make peace deals with Arabs.
Right.
And I think
Muslims.
With Muslims. And I say that because in Hebrew you say Aravim.
Right.
Which is really, they don't use the word Muslims. So when I translate from English.
No, it's okay. The only reason I do that is because not every Arab is a Muslim. And
they
hate being lumped in with the Muslims.
I understand. So I wanted to correct myself.
No, it's okay.
Where was I?
You were talking about how you try to live peacefully.
Right. So the rabbi of the yeshuv have always made efforts to reach out that little extra bit. And, you know, just so everybody knows, all the houses that are built here were built by Arabs, by Muslims. And we employ anywhere between 250 to 300 Palestinian workers a day.
Wow. That's very generous.
It's very generous.
And they say, and in the media it said that it's almost like you beat them with a whip daily.
Yeah, but we employ them and they throw rocks at us still on the highway, so...
It's unreal. And looking out, when I see this neighborhood that's lush green, prosperous,
it's beautiful.
But then I look at the Muslim neighborhoods on the hillsides...
Brown.
It's dead. Maybe they need to take a hint from the Jews on how to live a more blessed life.
I'll tell you something. It's not that they don't know how to garden, and it's not that they don't know how to build. Look at this house that you're in. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
It was built by Palestinians. But this land is blessed for Jews. A Muslim can plant a tree. And a Jew can plant a tree right beside him on the same piece of land, and this is honest. They've done it. They've researched it. They've looked into it. An Arab and a Muslim and a Jew can plant the same seed beside one another, and the Jew's tree will be double the size in double the time.
That's awesome. Look, I see blessing all around this Jewish state. I see greatness. And it's not acknowledged by the left. I don't care if they're Jew or not. They're probably the worst against their own people. And I don't want to go into a bunch of stuff about it. But at the end of the day, the fact of the matter is, this land has been blessed because it's been kissed by the Jewish people and by God first.
Exactly. I believe that also. I mean, you can look around here and you can see that it's pretty obvious that that's how it goes.
Jenna, listen, we're going to get you back on another time. We're thankful that you were willing to do what many refuse to do, And even though you may have not at times probably thought it was a sham, at the end of the day, you felt a calling. You listened to Hashem because of the seed planted and came back to the Jewish state, and we're thankful for it.
Thank you.
Thank you for taking the time to be with us. This is Michael Gonneau with Insight to Israel and the Middle East Research Center Limited on America's Web Radio. And we look forward to next week to keeping you updated. If you want to go to my Facebook page, Michael Gonneau, you can find where I update all the time about the work I'm doing here. You can find out about Hershey's for Heroes, where Americans are sending Hershey's chocolate bars with a note to the soldiers.
Send Hershey's!
Send Hershey's. And I'll tell you, they're grateful for it. Anyway, I want to say thank you to America's Web Radio for all that they do and for bringing the truth about the Jewish state to the grassroots of the United States of America, the patriot conservatives that are the best, the only true Americans. And I want to say God bless Israel in her fight for sovereignty and security. This is Michael Gonneau with the Middle East Research Center Limited, bringing you Insight to Israel, the truth about the greatness of the Jewish state and its struggle for sovereignty and security, every Sunday at 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.